Welcome to Synapse's Brain Bank podcast, a place for people and families impacted by brain injury to share their stories and connect with specialists from the field. Join our host, Dr. Zara Whedon, as we hear from everyday Australians and tap into advice and resources to help you on your brain injury path.
Today, we're talking to Dr. Alex Lean, who runs the Movement Disorder Service at the PA and Mater Hospitals in Brisbane. So tell us a bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, thank you very much for having me. As you said, I'm a neurologist here in Brisbane. As you might have realized from my accent, unless they fix it up, I'm German. But grew up in Germany and fell in love with a lovely Kiwi girl who tried to drag me to New Zealand via England. We kind of got stuck here. So now I'm what they call a Ger-Australian. And we have two lovely children who are both born and bred at Mater Hospital here. And I literally did all my training in Australia, apart from 1 year back in the UK. And we've been here now for unbelievably nearly 15 years.
A long time.
A long time.
Tell us a bit about movement disorders. Can you describe to our listeners?
Generally, I run the Movement Disorder Service at PA Hospital, and I guess the bread and butter stuff we look after there are people with Parkinson's disease, people with tremors, various types of tremors, people with dystonia, and large proportion of patients as well with tic disorders and other types of movement disorders. So that's really what we see generally in the movement disorder clinic, and the large bulk of them, biggest percentage, would be people with Parkinson's disease and what's called neurodegenerative diseases. So I have to probably declare here, I'm not a brain injury specialist. And yes, I do see some patients with certain movement disorders after brain injuries, but that's overall a small proportion of our whole cohort that we see. But you did ask about movement disorders in relation to brain injuries. And I guess if you look at this thing that we call our human brain as the computer that controls the body, doing damage to that can really cause a variety of different types of movement disorders. And as you can imagine, it's very rare to just do damage to one very small specific type of the brain that causes just one movement disorder. Often people, particularly with moderate to severe brain injuries, you see a combination of different movement disorders. And overall, the most common being tremors, and we can talk a bit more about it afterwards, what types of tremors and what causes those. Certainly different types of weaknesses or spasticity. Then a common movement disorder after brain injury would be chorea or athetosis. So chorea are like dance-like movements, and athetosis are like writhing type movements that can be really bothersome for patients. Some patients develop myoclonus or myoclonic jerks, and we can talk about it afterwards a bit more as well. But yeah, as we said beforehand, often a combination of different types of movement disorders that we see. So if we talk about tremors first, with tremors, there's three main types of tremors. Mm-hmm. You can look at one as rest tremors, and as the name suggests, they are tremors that occur while we're resting. So just let's say you sit on a sofa and just relax, and then part of the body is uncontrollably shaking. That'd be a rest tremor. And then the other types of tremors are action or postural tremors. And again, as the name suggests, action tremors are tremors that occur when you actually then start moving a body part. And postural tremors are when you hold certain things. Let's say hold a cup of tea or hold a glass in your hand and your body parts or your arm starts shaking with that. And in the setting of brain injuries, the most common tremor disorder you see are cerebellar tremors, and they cause what's called an intention tremor. And again, it's what it says on a tin. Intention tremors are tremors that occur when you actually start making a movement with intent and, for example, try to grab a glass of water or so. And they're really annoying because when you just sit there, you think, oh, there's nothing much wrong with someone. Mm-hmm. But of course, when you really need your body part or your arm be able to control well, is that intention movement. And then having a tremor while you do that can be really annoying and quite disabling for lots of patients. So they're the most common tremor types that you see in people with brain injuries. And I'll probably talk you quickly through the other types of movement disorders. So myoclonus, I mentioned beforehand, myoclonic jerks are, I guess, shock-like movements, kind of little jerks and twitches. And probably most of the listeners would have experienced those, you know, when you're about to go to sleep. You kind of just got a little twitch when So that's a myoclonic jerk, and they're perfectly normal for in case people are worried about that. But as you can imagine, that can be really irritating and, again, really disabling if they occur during wakefulness and while you're actually meant to do something and or hold a cup of coffee in your hand or so. It can be really, really nasty. And choreiform movements and athetosis are quite common as well, and they're often due to damage to the basal ganglia, which is a very deep part of the brain that's in charge of coordinating movements. And choreiform movements look a bit like someone's dancing. I'm not sure how good my dancing is, but dance-like movements, and often can be just writhing movements of arms that can be really interfering with purposeful movements of the parts of the body. And the last one I mentioned before and was dystonia as well. So dystonia sounds really fancy, but just means abnormal prolonged muscle contractions. So think of it like a cramp in a body part that doesn't go away. And that can be just a small part of the body. It might just be the hand, or it might be a whole segment of the body, just a whole arm or a whole leg, or it can be generalized dystonia. But one is, of course, it interferes with movements, but the other thing is it can be really painful. That ongoing, constant, abnormal contraction can be really nasty and really hard to treat for many patients as well.
So, Alex, can you tell us a bit about how you treat these problems?
Before we started recording the podcast, we talked about generally the role of neurologists in brain injuries. Mm-hmm. And I think largely for historical reasons and due to lack of manpower in most settings, certainly in Queensland, neurologists in the acute setting only have limited input, I think, in management of patients with brain injuries and with movement disorders due to brain injuries. And it's usually done in the brain injury rehabilitation units by rehabilitation doctors, and they do a fantastic job with that. So we often consult in the acute setting, but often just have a role of making diagnoses and giving advice. Mm-hmm. So in the acute setting, I think it would be fair to say we have limited impact and input on management of those disorders. And once you come out of this acute or immediate period after an injury and disorders stabilize and clinical pictures stabilize, I guess that's when we're more involved. And that's generally when those patients get referred through to my clinic then for input as well. And really, I think as a neurologist, our initial role is to diagnose correctly and get that right, because no doubt, unless you got the diagnosis right, it's hard to treat things appropriately.
Yeah.
And that has to be the first step of that. And then the treatment of, I think, like everywhere in life, and certainly like in other areas of brain injury, it has to be multidisciplinary treatment. So it's not as easy just throw a few tablets at someone.
Yeah.
While they have their role, medications, it's never just that one treatment for that. So in a lot of cases, this would be multidisciplinary with typically an occupational therapist or a physiotherapist we're working with. Medication can help to settle down or to facilitate that. And that would be, for example, in the area of, let's say, spasticity, anti-spasticity medication. And some of the listeners might have heard of baclofen or are treated with baclofen or dantrolene or those kind of medications. Or it might be in the area of tremors, so, uncontrollable shaking, anti-tremor medications. So things like propranolol or primidone that can really help to settle those tremors down. But realistically, really, to be honest, for the majority of patients, you're talking about settle them down a bit, not get rid of the tremors completely. That's generally not an achievable goal for medication themselves. So probably as a rule of thumb for a patient with just tablet therapy, if I can reduce their tremor severity by 30, 40, 50%, I'd be very happy with that. I think that'd be a very good outcome for that. For some patients, we actually do consider brain surgery to treat tremors, and it can be very effective, but needless to say, also invasive with risks again, and particularly then with risks for a brain that already has endured trauma to the brain beforehand and damage to the brain.
Yeah.
But for some severe tremor disorders after brain injuries, it can really be very effective therapy.
As a physician trainee and then physician, I really thought OTs go to people's houses and fix things so they can
some of them do
to things. And I thought physios really see you because you injured a muscle while you're running.
Some of them do.
But I've discovered since seeing OTs for a long time and physios for a long time and speech pathologists that I thought they just check swallow after a stroke, I've discovered many things they do and how useful they are, which it's good to learn when they're actually helpful for yourself, which I should have known anyway. Yeah. But, yeah, I can imagine in the multidisciplinary team that they help.
But for that, yeah, you want to have specialists, allied health, who know what to do with that. So, and I guess it's an increasingly complex world. So no disrespect, but an OT or physiotherapist who has no expertise in that area, they're probably not the right person to work with then.
So if you think that the person you're working with doesn't fit the situation, do you have the confidence to look around and find someone else?
As I just said, you want expertise, but the best therapist in the world is not going to be helpful for you if you don't feel comfortable with him or her or don't click with him or her. I do think actually that is the most important part, having someone who you click with. And let's face it, particularly outside of big centers, specialist therapists are hard to find. And I think we live in the real world as well, where you need to work with the resources that are around you and with a team around you that you click with and gel with. Still a lot can be done.
So maybe we could talk about the relationship between brain injury and dementia.
Interesting and very controversial topic as well. So I'm probably the listeners know that anyway. Generally, it's thought that mild traumatic brain injury, isolated, is quite a benign condition and most people recover quite well from that without any ongoing damage and without any ongoing issues. People might have heard in the more recent past of CTE, so chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a very controversial diagnosis, very difficult diagnosis, but very topical. So you might remember the movie Concussion with Will Smith that came out a few years ago that really created a lot of interest in that area. And in recent years, there are more and more football players and rugby players coming out who get diagnosed with CTE. Tricky thing with that is it can really only be diagnosed post-mortem. So as in after people have died, when you look at the brain under the microscope. So it's a very difficult diagnosis to make while people are still alive. So I'm sure lots more work to do in that area. So isolated mild brain injury, probably no risk for developing dementia or really minimally increased risk. Repeated mild brain injuries, that might be a different story. That might be increased risk. And that's probably the question with CTE, with this diagnosis, that might increase the risk for that. But it's generally accepted that moderate to severe traumatic brain injuries do increase the risk for the development of dementia. It's surprisingly harder to do research for that. You thought it's something so common, dementia, and brain injuries are so common. Surely you can do those studies well. But if you look at the data, even with very large patient groups, really hard to produce good quality data for that. So traditionally, it's thought that, I guess for what people know as the most common type of dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, it probably increases your risk twofold to develop Alzheimer's dementia. So clearly increased, but not as dramatic as people think either. But even that number is quite controversial and there's no kind of commonly accepted number for that. But overall, I would say most people in the field agree that having had moderate to severe traumatic brain injury does increase your risk to develop dementia, and significantly so.
What if you're seeing some symptoms from your loved one that might make you concerned about dementia? What would you suggest doing?
Again, interesting but really complicated area, and probably should explain the background a bit first. Yeah. So if we take that group of patients with moderate to severe traumatic brain injury, there will be damage to that brain, to that structure of the brain, that in many patients impacts on their cognitive abilities, on their thinking ability already, just from the direct injury. And so there's this acute phase of that as the injury has happened and as the brain hopefully partially or hopefully to a large degree recovers from that. But the difficult part with that is, so typically the patterns you see of thinking problems or cognitive problems in those patients is difficulty with processing of information, difficulty with attention, focus, concentration. And I probably should explain to people kind of a concept how the brain works. So if you think of this computer again that we got in there and that we call our brain, there are different parts to that in charge of different types of function. You got your memory apparatus and your planning part and your part of the brain in charge of being able to find your way around. And above that, do you have that layer of being able to attend and focus and concentrate on information? So even if you think in this quiet room we're sitting in at the moment, you need to be able to blank out everything else around you and listen to what I say to get that information into your brain. Yeah. You need to ignore the street out there, what's on the computer, all these kind of things around you, and just focus on that bit of information to then make some sense out of that, produce that memory, for example, or use that information to do something else. You can imagine if you struggle with that already, if you struggle with getting that stream of information into your brain, it's really hard to do anything else with that brain and do anything else with that cognitive ability. So having difficulty with that really impairs every other part of the brain function. Yeah. And you can imagine if you have an underlying brain injury that already causes problems with that. Let's say even if there was emerging other problems like developing dementia, that can be really hard to pick. What's even more complicating on top of that in people with brain injuries, often they are on medications, strong medications to treat, let's say, underlying epilepsy they might have developed or pain disorders that have developed after the injury. What are the most common side effects from all of those? Well, they zonk you out, make it even harder to think and to concentrate and be awake with. Yeah. And sadly, very commonly after people with brain injuries, they develop mood disorders. I guess depression would be the most common one, again, for various reasons. What's the most common abnormality of cognition, of thinking ability in those patients? Difficulty with concentration, difficulty with attention and focus. So there's so many factors to it outside of dementia that really can impair cognition, impair your thinking ability, that are not dementia itself. Yeah. And really what we mean is when we talk about dementia is neurodegeneration. Yeah. So brain cells dying off faster than they should. Yeah. And for every one of us in the room here, so our brains are at their peak at the age of 25. So for all of us, there's only one way after that, and that's downhill. So all our brains die off. All our brain cells get knocked off. But what happens in some patients, if they develop neurodegeneration, their brain cells or certain parts of the brain die off much quicker than they should for various reasons. And one of these neurodegenerative processes is what we call dementia, so when it causes problems with cognition. But you can imagine it's very hard to pick that in patients who have had significant underlying damage to the brain otherwise, and those other issues I alluded to beforehand. I should point out, though, how much does that matter? And the truth is, sadly at the moment, we don't have medical treatments to slow down or stop that underlying neurodegenerative process should that occur. Yeah. I do think it does matter though, because some of those other processes could well be treatable. So there might be changing over epilepsy medication, if that medication that someone's on at the moment is too sedating for them or zonks them out too much, because there might be other options that are less so. That might be treating an underlying mood disorder, let's say depression, more effectively, and treating that can improve cognitive abilities. That might be pain medication can be changed over to have less of those cognitive side effects. And that is very worthwhile to pick up, because these are very treatable things that can really make a difference for people's life.
Are there any strategies for people keeping their brain active?
Yep, most certainly are. I do have to say in advance, probably very boring advice, so bear with me on this one. No magic here involved. Overall, I guess what we need to accept, aging is the biggest risk factor to develop dementia. This is outside of brain injuries, and we don't have pills for aging yet. And I think we need to accept, I guess by evolution, we're not made to turn 100. We're really pushing our boundaries at the moment. So taking that into consideration, that aging we need to accept, there are certainly things, brain injury or not, that influence your risk to develop dementia or cognitive impairment or problems with your thinking ability in the future. And real big ticket items for that keep you brain active and keep you body active. And I think that evidence is very good. And we spoke about that before we actually started recording, that having a bit of buffer of the ability in your brain, if you then have damage to it, either from brain injury or with a dementing process, certainly helps. And I think that data is very clear for that. And even if you then had damage to it, the way I often look at it, both in cognitive ability as well as bodily functions, if you then accept for whatever reason, part of that system is not firing on all cylinders anymore, surely it's going to be a good thing to kind of optimize the rest that does still work as much as you possibly can. And that for me makes a lot of sense, and it's supported by evidence. So please do that. There is not good evidence if there's only one specific type that needs to be done. So it's not like, oh, you need to do Sudokus, but you can't do crosswords or something like that. I think anything that suits you works. And generally for that, I would advise do things you enjoy doing rather do things that you hate doing and you then only do it once a month. So do something that you enjoy doing. And for physical activity, if that's going for a walk now every day, whereas beforehand you just sat on the sofa, great. If that's for cognitive ability, rather than just watching the Netflix up and down, do actually a bit more and do some reading of something interesting or have more discussions with people. Any of that is fine. I don't think there's just one golden path to that. So that's kind of exercising, both cognition and physical exercise. What you put in your body really makes a difference as well. And again, that data is very clear. Good diet certainly makes a difference. And we always talk about the Mediterranean diet, which seems to fix everything. It's just amazing.
Those
Italians, they've got it all sorted. And so Mediterranean diet really means lots of fruit, lots of veg, lots of nuts, lots of fish, which is a problem because I don't like fish, not too much meat, which I'm easy with. So that's really the Mediterranean diet, which is healthy for all things, prevents heart attacks and strokes as well, but good for cognition as well. Then, sorry, as much as I like my beer as well, not too much alcohol. It really makes a difference. No smoking. Sorry, I think most people would agree with that nowadays. And really address your other vascular risk factors. So that's diabetes, blood pressure, cholesterol, those kind of things really make a difference. And one thing I just read up yesterday, interestingly, I wasn't aware of, building up a good social network around you. So having a good social network around you not only helps for obvious reasons if you have problems with your cognition, but actually can reduce the risk of developing dementia in the future. I think the difference that you see in the European cultures, that binge drinking is not part of the culture. Yeah. So they have a glass of wine, maybe even for lunch, and a glass of wine for dinner, but not five, and not a bottle of something else than at night. I think that's the real difference. And I think it's a beautiful culture to have. And drinking like that, clearly for whatever you do, there's always a balance of good and bad sides, but doing it like that, I think is absolutely appropriate. And for most people, not harmful and probably even helpful. But yeah, I think that binge drinking culture we have, not only in this country, but in many, many parts of the world, is a real problem.
So thank you, Alex, for coming today. And it's been really useful, the things that you've shared.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Brain Bank podcast, brought to you by Synapse, Australia's peak body for brain injury. Make sure you visit our website, synapse.org.au, where you'll find useful resources and tools to connect you to our brain injury community. And while you're there, please complete the podcast survey. We want to know what you've enjoyed, what's worked for you, and what you think we should cover in the next series. At Synapse, we're creating change for people from all walks of life who have been impacted by brain injury. Remember to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode.